Discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. You should always consult with an investment professional before making important investment decisions. Securities offered through J.W. Cole Financial, Inc., member FINRA, and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI, an SEC-registered investment advisor. 674 South College Avenue, Bloomington, Indiana. Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Big Show, Your Money with David Hayes. Thanks so much for hanging out with us. Tom Bunger's our guest today, local estate planning attorney, a regular on the program, probably over the last decade at least. He's going to be talking about what you need to do to prepare your estate and what documents that you need to have and all that goes into that, the thinking behind it as well. He'll be joining us just in a few minutes. Let's go do a little news of the week first, of course, brought to you by the class we're teaching over at Ivy Tech, the Center for Lifelong Learning. It's called Rejuvenate Your Retirement. If you go online at ivytech.edu, it will say that the enrollment is closed, but they will actually take enrollment all the way up until the day before. So the class, first class starts on Tuesday, January 26th, and then we'll kick off another class on Thursday, January 28th. So a lot of information during that two days of class. It's about 4 hours total in length, so you want to check that out. Hey, I know the market's been more than rocky. It's kind of been thumped here at the beginning of the year, but as the stock market faces its worst January since 2009, there's actually a few bond funds that are alleviating some of the stock market's pain. Believe it or not, the 10-year Treasury note has fallen down below 2%. It was actually around 2.27% at the end of 2015. Of course, everyone thought the Fed would start raising rates and interest rates would go up. But as you've heard on the show, that in past experiences, we've actually seen the 10-year go down. And when interest rates go down, the highest quality bonds were going up in value. Now, high-yield bond funds have been clobbered. They're down. So the bonds that have any risk perception at all have gone down. But, you know, rates could go down even more. The, you know, as an example, the German 10-year bond is sitting around 0.48%. Japan's 10-year government bond is still under 1. And even Italy's 10-year yield is lower than the U.S., offering up just 1.65% for the use of your money over the next 10 years. So, folks, there's a lot more to bonds than just what the U.S. non-farm payrolls say. And then, you know, as we look at our economy, the U.S. has actually been expanding since July of 2009. This comes from By the Numbers. And the expansion has reached now 78 months in length. That goes all the way back, again, till 2009. That's a duration that's only been exceeded four other times in the U.S. So I think a lot of folks are looking at that and thinking maybe we're kind of moving into a recessionary time. We don't necessarily think that, but the GDP growth for 2015 is going to report out on Friday the 29th, and it's going to probably be less than 3% again, which will be a record 10th consecutive year of sub-3% growth. That's the longest streak in U.S. history of minus or below 3% growth. Let's look at one more piece here. A lot of folks always ask this question. If you have an option for a Roth 401k, is it better to put money on the Roth side or the traditional side? Well, as a person is going long saving money into the plan, really the question is about the taxes. Are you currently in a lower tax bracket than you'll likely be later on down the road? So you're married with three kids? The answer is more than likely yes. But even for higher income earners, and I've been working with a lot of physicians lately saying, hey, we need to bone up this Roth side because all of your money is tax deferred. Well, if all of your money is tax deferred, just a quick tax law change could all of a sudden put you in a very, very bad situation tax-wise. Required minimum distributions start at 70.5. They keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So you want, just like in, on the investment side, you want diversification. You want tax diversification when it comes to your money so you have choices in retirement. So I really think no matter what side of the aisle you're on, whether you're in a lower tax bracket now or a higher tax bracket now, each situation is certainly different. And then finally, I found this pretty darn interesting. We all heard about Kevin Wilson's new contract here with Indiana University, puts him solidly in the middle of the Big Ten as far as compensation for coaches go. But did you watch the national championship game? I did. I stayed up for the whole thing. I was so proud of myself. Alabama football coach Nick Saban earned $310,000 of bonus money when his team won the college football title game versus Clemson on January 11th. But that's just a drop in the bucket because Saban's base salary, $6.9 million. Not bad. Hey, we're going to take a break when we come back. Tom Bunger, local estate planning attorney and partner over at Bunger & Robertson, will be with us live. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. Your Money with David Hayes again. Please check us out over at the Ivy Tech Lifelong Learning Center. Rejuvenate your retirement. It's coming up soon. It's actually a pretty small class. You know, typically we'll have big numbers in these classes, and we decided to tinker with the schedule and go in January. So it's a pretty small class, pretty intimate class. So if you want to sign up, do it. It's like 30, 40 bucks to go. I can't really remember, but go there, sign up. And I think it'll be really good just because of the smaller class size. But please do us a favor and show up at the class. Again, go to ivytech.edu to sign up. Tom Bunger's our guest tonight on the big show. And Tom, it was actually last March you were on the show with me, but I think you've been on at least once a year for the last 7, 8, 9, 10 years. I've been doing this 13 years.
At least. I think that's a fair statement.
And you don't look at one day older, just so you know.
You're kind. I appreciate that. I appreciate that.
We usually start off this show, and I think it's not redundant at all just to put it out there, about estate planning 101 and really what estate planning is. Because I think a lot of people, when we talk about estate planning, they think of, you know, people that have estates, big estates, you know, things they really have to worry about.
Right.
And we also have referred to planning from a personal perspective, that most people spend more time worrying about their spring break vacation and planning more for that than they do planning their estate.
Occasionally before they go, they think they need to do a will, but yeah, you're right.
Right at the last minute. So right. Just basic 101 estate planning, what it is and really what does it mean for most people?
I like to say it's choice, it's decision. Estates, we all have something that goes someplace when we die, and the choice is ours. We can make the decision about where they're going to go. We can make the decision about who's going to get it where I want it to go. Mm-hmm. Or we can not make a decision. But you need to recognize not making a decision, to use that old cliche, is a decision, because the state of Indiana decides for you where your property goes if you don't.
Now, if you have something owned individually just by yourself, right, half goes to your spouse if you're married and half goes to your kids. A lot of folks don't know that.
That is correct.
It's pretty big reason to do some estate planning.
True. And you got to remember, anything we're going to talk about tonight is Indiana, and that could be different from different states. Mm-hmm. But Indiana, that's the law in the state of Indiana that's going to happen to my individual property if I don't decide. Now, there's nothing that says I have to leave anything to a child. But again, that's the decision I make. If I don't make that will, if I don't make that decision, I've decided that I want it 50-50.
So let's talk about direct transfer assets, things that don't go through your will first. Because
yes,
if I have an account with my wife, Misty, joint with rights of survivorship, I die, it goes to her. But
right,
there's a lot of other investments and in assets that will go as direct transfer as well and avoid all of the documentation, the wills and such.
Exactly. Again, it's a decision, and how you title property can decide where it goes. And in the state of Indiana, as it stands today, basically any asset that can be titled with a direction on where it passes at death, a transfer on death.
Mm-hmm.
From real estate to your motorcycle to your boat, anything that the Bureau of Motor Vehicles can title can be transferred.
And bank accounts are pay on death typically.
Pay on death, investment accounts.
Yeah, they're transfer
exactly
on death as well.
Exactly.
And then again, other things that are direct transfer, like beneficiary things that have a beneficiary form.
Right, and just had that question within the last couple of weeks. Somebody passed away. They had a trust that mm-hmm. said, I want this asset to go to Mr. B. But they had a beneficiary designation on that asset that said that it went to C. Well, as you know, mm-hmm. you don't change the beneficiary on that life insurance policy in my trust.
Yeah, that's the will of that money.
That's right. I do it by completing the form and the contract I've got with the asset holder. Yeah. So it ended up going not where they thought it was going to go.
Yeah, we're always talking about aligning your beneficiary designations with your estate plan.
Exactly.
And as we talk about those beneficiary forms, Tom, you know, almost everything, that's the case. There's only a rare instance where it's not the case, where if you have someone listed as a beneficiary that may not go, and that's a qualified retirement account.
Right.
At work, you know, if you're at work and have a 401k, you're married, your current spouse would have to sign off on that for it not to go to them.
That's what the law says.
But everything else, IRAs, life insurance, annuities, anything else, it doesn't really matter.
That's correct.
But things that are in our name individually, that's what gets directed by our individual will, and that's what's the most common document people bring up.
That's right. And the way to look at it is that asset that's in my name individually, not with any transfer on death direction, mm-hmm. no beneficiary designated, has got to go someplace. The will is where you direct where you want it to go. That's the document where you say, this is where I want that asset that lacks direction. You give it direction on where it goes.
We're going to take a break. Tom, when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about trust. You know, who's a good candidate for a trust? What do they do, the different types of trust? Then I want to move into the other documents that are as equally as important, if not more so in some cases, and that's power of attorneys and healthcare representatives, a living will, all the things and more. We'll be back. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. Your Money with David Hayes. Tom Bunger, local estate planning attorney and a regular on the big program, is with me. And Tom, we were talking about direct transfer of assets and wills, but also very, very important, at what point or what things could trigger you to step back and say, hey, I really need to look at this stuff again?
I think any change in circumstance as far as the loss of a spouse, a change in a marital situation, a change in a child's marital situation, all those things where you've got beneficiaries designated, again, coming back that that's a contract and you need to make sure that it's current and update and is doing what you want it to do, because it's only going to be changed by you, and you want to make sure that it is going where you want it to go.
Yeah, and that's the beneficiary forms, and in addition to the will and the trust and things like that. I mentioned off air that I had a situation come up where a client of ours passed away, and somehow, some way, we had missed an account that was an online account only, and his deceased wife was the beneficiary.
Right.
From many years ago.
Right.
Well, the estate had to be opened up for that deceased spouse, and this person already remarried, and I mean, it was a mess. But you know, just knowing what you have is pretty darn important.
And that's you know, we talked about the estate and having that list of what's there. Again, we'll see people still coming in with a policy book, and you've seen them where they came each day and each week, and they gave them a quarter, and they've got the book, and it's $1,000 policy. But if I haven't changed the beneficiary when my spouse died, a lot of those don't have contingent beneficiaries. And you're right, we're either opening the estate or we're waiting 45 days to do the small estate affidavit. Why take that? You know, why set yourself up for delay? It's just simply getting the form and getting it completed.
Let's talk about trust, Tom. There's basically a couple different types of trust. There's a revocable trust, there's irrevocable trust, but also a trust called a testamentary trust that gets created upon your death.
In your will.
Talk about trust and who are good candidates for trust, the differences between the two.
Sure. In simplified terms, a trust is just is setting aside assets to be held for the benefit of someone. I can do a living trust, an inter vivos living trust for myself, where I am my own trustee. Mm-hmm. I create it. I'm the trustee, and I'm the beneficiary. And I put my assets into that trust, and then I provide that direction on where those properties go when I die. I name a successor trustee. I name new beneficiaries, and it functions like a will, but it avoids probate. Now, I can do that with assets that I've got now and fund that trust, or just as we talked about, I can create that trust and it's not funded until I die, and that trust may well be a part of a testamentary trust, which just simply means it's a trust in a will. And, you know, I'm a candidate if I have family circumstances where I've got a beneficiary that's perhaps not a good money manager, mm-hmm. and they're going to need help. So while I'm around and I make decisions to see when they get money, I help them meet obligations because they're great folks, but they can't figure out how to pay bills. They're not organized in that fashion. They're not blessed with that skill.
Mm-hmm.
So what I don't want to do when I die, while I can't take my money with me, I can set it aside in a trust, have a third party hold those monies, invest that money, see that their bills are paid, exercise judgment that when I think this beneficiary needs money based upon a criteria and set of circumstances that I have directed and set out in that document. So to get somebody to hold monies for them, maybe I'm taking care of a parent and I don't want to give the money to the parent, but if I were to predecease, I want to make sure my mom or dad are taken care of. So perhaps I set it exactly a testamentary trust up in my will that if mom or dad survive, you know, I've been helping them. I want to set some money aside to take care of them. So you do it for that. Again, from a planning perspective, sometimes people want to provide a source of funds because we don't have the assets we have are not cash, so I can't necessarily pay bills. So you might do a special type of a trust, an irrevocable life insurance trust, an ILIT is the term everybody likes to use, where we're creating a source of funds to be held in a trust so that we've got cash so that perhaps maybe I don't have to sell that asset or change the character or go into debt for that business. I provided cash.
It's important to sit down with someone that can ask the right questions to help construct the right plan.
And the important thing too, there's not a one trust fits all circumstances. So you're exactly right. Sitting down with the person and crafting that document that meets your need, not putting your needs into a document that's pre-existing, but to come up with, sit down with somebody who knows what they're doing and set the document up so that it meets your goals.
So it sounds like a revocable trust is one that you can change in your lifetime. You typically set it up. You're the beneficiary. You run it. It's used to avoid probate and also maybe to help construct how a beneficiary receives money once you're gone. An irrevocable trust, you mentioned that on the life insurance side, it literally removes it from my estate.
Exactly.
And what's the purpose of that?
Well, depending upon the size of one's estate, it could be for tax purposes. Recognizing now, though, and from the federal state tax perspective, we're dealing with an individual exemption of $5.4 million and some change in a marital situation, basically twice that.
Mm-hmm.
But there are certainly people out there that have estates or businesses or real estate or things of that nature that are larger than that. So instead of opening that up to the tax, because now, while that's a large exemption, if my estate is sufficient enough to meet that tax obligation, we're talking at a 50%, we're talking a 50% tax rate. We're talking 50 cents on the dollar. So
if
that is a tool used to protect the asset and also provide cash.
So people also use it when they have special needs children.
Exactly.
Or they have they want to do some asset protection in case someone gets in a nursing home, and there's a whole set of complexities there as well. Tom, when's it a good idea to have a trustee that's not yourself to be either a family member or a fiduciary trustee? You're a fiduciary in either capacity, but like a bank trustee as opposed to a family member.
Again, being a trustee is not an easy proposition. I'm now dealing with somebody else's monies. I've got to manage that money, make sure that it's invested properly. I've got to distinguish between income and principal.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as simple as I'm going to go down and open a bank account and pay bills. I've got a responsibility to get a reasonable return on the money. I also have a responsibility to that current perhaps income beneficiary, but I've also got to maintain principal for perhaps the end beneficiary of the assets of the trust estate itself. So you need somebody who is savvy in dealing with funds. Now, maybe savvy means I know that I need to go get a professional investor to help me manage that money.
Mm-hmm.
So I may name a brother, a sister, or a family member to do it, but I also can rely on them to do it, to go to that professional, or in the document I draft myself, I can appoint and designate the professional that they're going to deal with. Otherwise, I can name an advisor to the trustee who will be there to assist on investment, who will be there to decide, is this the right, do we hold on to this asset, sell this asset? So you need somebody who understands the responsibility, who also has the ability, I would suggest, to say no.
Yeah.
Because when you give it to the discretion of the trustee, your really intention is for them to look at it, and just as mom and dad might say no, maybe we need this person to look at them and say no.
Well, and also it's not easy to find a bank trust department to take a trust that's less than $1 million.
And that's the reality of today's economy, and that's the reality of Bloomington. I mean, the ability and the options we have for corporate fiduciaries, it's not getting any larger. It's just getting smaller.
We're going to take another break, Tom. When we come back, I want to get into some of these other documents that people are going to need and then how you select who it is that's going to serve in these capacities. And we're going to talk about powers of attorney, healthcare representatives, living wills. We got a lot to talk about with just a little bit of time. We'll be back. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. Your Money with David Hayes. In the class Rejuvenate Your Retirement, if you go online again and they say registration's closed. It's not. You can override it and get in and pay your money and come on to the class. And we'll be talking in detail about a lot of the same things that Tom and I are talking about as far as proper estate planning goes and the things that you need to know. You'll get your course book. It's a really big textbook. We go through things in detail. You can ask questions. People that come really, really enjoy it, and they feel like they get more than their money's worth. For sure. Tom Bunger is my guest, local estate planning attorney, partner with Bunger and Robertson. And the Bunger part actually didn't originate with Tom. It originated with Lynn, his dad.
That's true. You're
and,
right.
And our good friend of who's also passed, Don Robertson. So
indeed.
Great article, by the way, in BizNet last
week. Thank
you.
That
was terrific.
Thank you.
And I think that keeping the name Bunger and Robertson is absolutely the right thing to do because, as you know, attorneys' boards, they shift around.
They do.
And I don't know if that's an ego thing or what, but
they tend
to do that. And Tom's our guest. Tom, let's talk about, we talked about selecting a person to serve in that capacity. What whether it's a successor trustee, whether it's the executor, whether it's going to be someone to serve as a power of attorney or to help make healthcare decisions. Sometimes that can get a little bit overwhelming, who to pick, guardianship for your kids. But what I tell folks is think about this planning in five-year increments. What
sure.
would happen in the next – what would I want to have happen in the next 5 years? Who to do this, who to do that? Like I have my dad set up as the trustee of the money to help take care of Will if Misty and I were gone. My brother Dan would take care of Will.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 10 years from now, I might say, well, maybe Dad's not in a position that he either – doesn't want to, or maybe he can't.
Right.
So we would
right.
change that. So do you think that's a logical way to think about it?
That's an excellent way to think about it. And easy for me because I draft the documents, but I think as our kids were growing up, we changed the guardian of the children six times
mm-hmm.
because the circumstance where the kids were at that point or where the life circumstance of the guardian at that time, the people we'd named. So by all means, that's something to look at. And always it should be something to consider and change if circumstances change.
Let's talk about powers of attorney.
Yes.
So a power of attorney, we hear the word springing power of attorney, durable power of attorney. But as far as a power of attorney goes, just what is a power of attorney?
Power of attorney is when I give authority to someone to act on my behalf. I can have a general power of attorney, which just like the word general means, basically anything that could be defined, that person can do. Then you hear the word general durable power of attorney. When I started practice of law 40 years ago, if I gave you a power of attorney and I became incapacitated, you could no longer act because it was the mirror image. So the idea was the person granting the power can't act, therefore the person to mm-hmm. whom I've given the power can't act. But then the idea of durable came in, which basically says, even if the person giving the power, if the person giving the power is incapacitated, that does not limit the ability of the person to whom the power is given to do it. Then I can have a specific purpose power of attorney. You may have a real estate transaction that you're going to be out of town and that needs to be taken care of. So we do a specific power of attorney that enables somebody mm-hmm. to sign your name to sell the property, to sign the loan documents, the closing statement, that type of thing. Or I want them to have access to a bank account. I don't want to give them ownership, so I don't want to make it a joint account. Now, I can go to the bank and perhaps just give them signature power, but I don't have to go to the bank if I take this power of attorney and say, I've got an account at this account number X at ABC Bank, and I want Joe here to have my power of attorney to access and sign anything and deal with that account as if it's me. And then Joe's got the authority, but it's limited to that account. So I don't have to worry mm-hmm. that they're going to go into my savings account at the credit union and do something.
So a general durable power of attorney, that's the most common.
Yes.
And a lot of those powers of attorney don't get sprung into action until there's an incapacitation.
Okay, good point. Yes, and you brought up the word springing. And so if you take those same words and you say springing general durable power of attorney, what we do by definition is say that power of attorney comes into effect and the typical thing that triggers it is the person's incapacity. So because they say, well, I don't want them using that while I'm capable. So, what we can do is draft a document that says when two treating physicians say that you are no longer capable of taking care of your things, then this power of attorney comes into effect, and then that person has the authority to act for me, and not until that point.
My personal experience, personal family experience, is that that would be a real pain. Whenever you need it, you need it. And to go out and try to get the neurologist and the general, and here's the thing, some of your aging parents that you don't really know what's going on all the time, yeah, you know they're getting a little bit forgetful, yeah, you know that maybe they're not showing up places where you think they're supposed to show up. They may not have
been. You're talking about me now, David. Be careful.
They may not have gone to a doctor
right
in the last 5 years.
True.
And that's happened in our family. Yeah, so I know this. So having that clause could have been a major inconvenience. So we just eliminated that clause altogether and said, hey, if I'm going to give you my power of attorney, I love you, I trust you, I'm going to give it to you.
And you and I have shared the same feeling. I am not a proponent of a springing power of attorney for that very reason. It's typically not a document I say, well, next week I think I may have a situation, and there's an immediate need for that, and that's why the person's looking to use it.
Yeah.
And all we're doing is delaying it. And the other reality is, too, and I'm sure you found in your dealings with people, we create this power of attorney, and still the individual, the asset holder that you're dealing with gets the power of attorney, and they don't like it. They want it on their form, we're arguing with them over the regular power of attorney, let alone adding on that additional requirement of trying to show that the person's currently incapacitated with doctor statements.
Well, it was well documented that USAA, very well-known insurance company investment company, has their own form.
Right.
And if you're a member of USAA and you think your power of attorney is good, you better check it out, because they have their own.
And that which is extremely frustrating to us as professionals, because we draft what under the law are effective documents. There's nothing in the law that says a power of attorney expires or is no longer good after it's 6 years old. Yeah. I mean, it's a planning tool to have in place to help me when I need help. And all of a sudden, here is the child going to this financial institution with a power of attorney. It might be 7 years old, but mom and dad haven't changed their intent. They haven't changed their mind, and they've suffered a stroke and in the hospital. And we're saying, well, you know, that's not a current mm-hmm. document. What am I supposed to do here? It's extremely frustrating to them and to us as we've tried to help the individual.
Yeah, it comes in handy when you need to get into the safe deposit box, or you need to transact at the bank because your mom or dad can't do it for themselves any longer. So I think that's, for us, has been one of the most powerful and important documents, for sure.
It's a great tool.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Tom Bunger. We're going to get into some of the other things that we haven't had a chance to talk about yet, which is the healthcare power of attorney, for lack of a better word, the living will. What are those? What do they mean? And then also, is it important to have an appointment of healthcare representative for an adult child? You know, as my kid goes, I don't need one. He's 15 years old. He gets hurt in an accident. I go check up on him. Everything's fine. But what if they're 25 or 26 or 40 years old, 50 years old? If I'm in a wreck and I'm in the hospital with all the privacy rules of these days, can my dad come in and get information to help the situation out? I don't know. We're going to ask the professional when we come back. This is Your Money with David Hayes. You know, Tom mentioned this earlier in the program. Tom Bunger's my guest. Welcome back, everyone, about the federal estate tax limit. You know, everyone's worried about taxes when it comes to death, and maybe you should be. But we're going to talk briefly about taxes because I don't want to forget it. It's very, very important. And Tom, you mentioned the federal estate tax limit is $5,450,000 for 2016. If you're married, you double that up. So if you have an estate that's lower than that, you don't have a federal estate tax problem. In Indiana, no longer is there an inheritance tax for
it's
the
gone.
Most part, which is terrific. It used to
in
not
any part,
be that
it's
way.
Gone.
Yeah, there's not even that little bit.
Nope.
I don't even talk about that.
Nope.
Okay, good. No inheritance tax,
which means
in Indiana.
They don't freeze bank accounts. You don't have to get consents to transfer.
Oh, man. Those were the bad old days.
They were.
For sure. Income taxes, they're going to be due on accounts like IRAs and things
yes.
that your parents
yes.
or husband or wife has not paid on before. But the one I wanted to talk somewhat about is gifting, because everyone gets this mixed up and messed up. They think that if I give more than $14,000, I think it's still $14,000 away.
It is. It didn't go up
to any one person, then someone's going to pay tax. I'm going to pay it. They're going to pay it. Someone's going to pay it. But Tom, they just get this thing wrong.
Right. Okay. First of all, no gift tax in Indiana. So the annual what you're talking about is an annual exclusion that I can give to somebody up to $14,000. What that speaks to is then I don't use any of my 5.4 $4 million. But if I give more than $14,000 to an individual, that means I am obligated to file a gift tax return. But on that return, I would show, say, a gift of $15,000. I still have that $5,400,000 and whatever we've got. So I've used $1,000 of that. There is no tax due. There's no place for the individual who receives the gift to report it on their individual income tax return because it's a gift. It's not earned income. Now, unless it's to a charity, there's no deduction for it. But the bottom line is, the $14,000 is a filing requirement, and until my total gifts exceed lifetime transfers, exceed that $5.4 million figure, nobody's paying any tax. I'm just using up my lifetime exemption.
Do you find that people actually file these informational returns?
No.
I don't either. I tell people this is the way it works, but practically I don't ever see people file.
And it was probably more of an issue when the exemption wasn't so high, because the advantage of filing the return, if I've got an asset that there's a questionable value on, you know, I've got a closely held business corporation, or I've got some real estate that I'm trying to parcel out to my children, and so I'm giving a percentages at a time. The advantage of filing the return is it starts the statute on what the value is of that asset and may stop the service from being able to question what the gift value was.
When I teach the classes at Ivy Tech, Rejuvenate Retirement or our Retirement Readiness class, and we get to the gifting section, I always ask the crowd, hey, who in here thinks that if I give more than this $14,000 that you, me, someone's going to pay tax? 9 out of 10 people raise their hand and say, yes, we believe that someone's going to pay tax. And I'm only being a little bit generous. It's usually 10 for 10.
Right.
So it's a very misunderstood thing for sure.
It's fair to say it's a taxable transfer when it's over 14, but the exemption is so high that very rare would the tax be paid.
Let's back up and get to the healthcare representative. We talked about wills. We've talked about trust, the importance of powers of attorney. But a very, very important document, especially in this society of privacy, is a healthcare representative, having one of those in place.
Yeah, the general durable power of attorney, I like to look at it as an asset document. The healthcare representative is a personal document. It's somebody being able to consent to medical care for you when you can't.
Mm-hmm.
That is the intent of the document. So somebody makes a decision. Now, you also brought up a good point about how if I want to check on my child's healthcare. And under HIPAA, you know, the treating physicians, the healthcare providers are restricted on who they can share information to. Maybe I don't want to give somebody my healthcare decision. I don't want to make them my healthcare representative. But the state of Indiana also has a statute that enables me to give a release, basically a HIPAA release document, and it may list multiple family members who have no decision-making authority, but what they have is the right to be told what's going on and to understand my medical condition, the treatment, everything else that's going on. So it's basically it's a healthcare release, a HIPAA release that enables them to be privy to what's going on with my health.
So is that a document that now is the best practice to put with a power of attorney?
Probably. I will see people use that maybe if there are multiple family members, and I want one child making decisions, but I don't necessarily want the other to feel obligated or they would be uncomfortable with that, but I want them to know what's going on. Again, knowledge in these situations avoids a lot of conflict, so the ability to where they don't feel left out. But
now, you can get information about your minor children, I assume. But whenever you have an adult child, what are the complexities?
Well, your analogy about the adult is right. They're no longer my dependent. I'm no longer responsible for them.
And this is a you know, a kid that's, what, 19, 20
that's
years
right.
old?
I mean, they may not be married.
Or independent.
Or independent. Well, the independence may be a whole nother hour, David. But the bottom line is I'm not their guardian. And they are an adult, so therefore it puts that healthcare provider in a difficult position. Mm-hmm.
So a good question to ask folks would be, do you have adult children? I mean, we know this through the planning process.
Right.
Maybe it would be a good idea to at least get the HIPAA release,
right,
if not even having you as the healthcare power of attorney to be able to make those
decisions. Yeah, because we think about
overlooked.
It, I'm going to help mom,
right,
but the situation may come where I've got to do it for them.
Big time overlooked. Let's talk about the living will. Again, something that a lot of folks just kind of include in the package, I guess, when it comes to your estate documents.
Living will's the use or non-use of life support system, life support when a physician certifies in writing that I have an incurable injury, disease, or illness. My death is imminent. The use of life prolonging procedures is only artificially prolonging the dying process. So it says, I don't want that. Indiana gives you three choices. I want artificially supplied food and hydration, even if the effort to sustain life is futile or excessively burdensome to me. Or B, I do not want that if the effort to sustain life is futile, excessively burdensome to me. Or C, I'm not going to decide. I leave it up to my healthcare representative to make that call.
Very important document. Hey, Tom, let's talk about, you know, we talk about financial assets and how I want to leave things. But, you know, in this day and age of technology, we have passwords for everything.
Excellent.
Is this something that you find now that you're talking with people about
yes.
in the estate planning process?
Yes.
Getting the passwords, knowing where the safe deposit keys are. I mean, all these little details.
That's extremely critical. And today, you know, how do I get out of the Facebook? How do I get to these email messages that are not there? If I don't have the password, I can't get to it. And again, safe deposit box keys. There is not a master key to the safe deposit box.
No, it's a couple $100 getting drilled out.
Exactly, exactly.
But you need the power of attorney to be able to drill it out if there's still alive.
Yeah, that's.
And don't forget, folks, that a power of attorney is a living document. When you die, that power of attorney ceases, and now someone else steps into the shoes of making decisions, and that's the executor or the trustee.
That's exactly right. That's the one disability a durable power of attorney cannot overcome, and that's death.
What do you find, Tom, as far as just unforeseen things that people, again, we've talked a lot about a lot of those things that maybe things you haven't even thought about, but as you have settled estates, what are some of the unforeseen things that have crept up that we need to maybe inform people about?
Again, I think the biggest thing is not having a list or of my assets and not knowing the current beneficiaries. More times than not, I would say every third estate that comes in, there will be a life insurance policy where they didn't update the beneficiary, and therefore we're into either, depending on the size of the policy, having to open an estate, or the 45 days. Indiana does have a small estate process and procedure for estates, net estates under $50,000. But that account or asset cannot be released until 45 days after the date of death.
We are going to take our very last break, and I'm just going to encourage people. You know, we did talk about this at the top of the show, that change your mindset. Just do something about it. You know, not doing anything is a decision. And don't spend more time planning that spring break vacation than planning your estate. And talk with a professional. We can help answer questions. Tom can help in a major kind of way. So we encourage you to reach out to someone for help. We're going to take a break. We'll come back, wrap up the big show. This is Your Money with David Hayes. All right, everyone, welcome back. Just a couple minutes left in the big show. Again, go to ibtech.edu, rejuvenate your retirement. It's a class for people that are really already retired. We're going to be doing our retirement readiness class in just a few more weeks, and this is also through the Center for Lifelong Learning. I'm not sure if that's up and running yet, but it's based on our book, Today's Guide to Retirement Planning. You'll get a free copy of the book. It is the textbook, and we'll go through some very detailed areas of the book that really are meaningful to people, and we're looking forward to it, and it's going to be $30 or $40 to go. I can't remember, but it's well worth the money. So again, go to the Center for Lifelong Learning through Ivy Tech. Check it out. Check out all their classes. They have some really, really neat things that they offer. Also, next week, Mick Higley, the publisher of By the Numbers, which is something that I've used forever here on the show, just some little tidbits about the markets, the economy. He was the one that had the Nick Saban reference where Nick made like 350 or 80 grand by winning the national championship with Alabama, but his base salary is $6.9 million. All that stuff comes from By the Numbers. And I've known Mick a long, long time, and he will bring something very interesting, very creative, and will help you look at some things in a different way. He's a statistician at heart. He doesn't predict the future, but he gives you some different and interesting ways to look at things. So looking forward to that. And then the following week, I'll actually be out of town in a study group that I'm part of, and Doug Hughes and Rod Holloway will come and anchor the show. That will be the investment show. So we really are lining up some outstanding programs here for the next few weeks. And of course, today we had Tom Bunger, local estate planning attorney and good friend, been on the show for, we think, at least a decade, spreading the wonderful information that he does. And if you heard only parts of it and would like to catch more of it, You can always catch it on my favorite time to listen, which is Saturday mornings at 9 a.m. And no, I don't listen to my show every Saturday morning at 9. But if I'm out driving around, I do tune in because I want to critique the show. I want to say, oh my gosh, why did I say that? Or how come I said it that way? And then you can always catch it on WGCLradio.com. Tom, when you catch the show, when do you catch it? On Thursday nights or Saturday mornings?
I'm typically a Saturday morning listener.
Well, and you and I did that for years. We would stop
yes,
at
Wee
Willie's for breakfast.
We did.
Which I really missed that. And then come in and do an early morning show. And I will say that the Thursday night edition I've had to get used to because my energy level was really high on Saturday mornings. And after a long day at the office, sometimes it's not so much on Thursday. And when I first started doing the show on Thursday nights, I actually would stop seeing people, stop taking phone calls, stop doing anything at like 1 or 2 o'clock so I could just sort of reboot. But now they run me right up to the edge every Thursday.
Get here at 5 till 6, you're ready to go.
Oh,
right?
My gosh, yeah. Well, but the preparation for the show is done throughout the week,
right?
Not just right at the last minute, even though I'm sure that people listening think that it actually is right at the last minute. So, again, Tom, thanks so much for being part of the show.
And always a pleasure.
Again, the importance of estate planning cannot be emphasized enough because for someone who is living proof of this in our family where we've had to deal with estate planning issues, and this is living issues, we haven't even had to deal with the death side of things yet from a parental standpoint, it's something that needs to be done. It needs to be talked about. I mean, you need to have family get-togethers, family meetings, and talk about this stuff because whenever the light switch goes off, it goes off. You'll have that come to Jesus day. It happens to everybody. And you need to all be on the same page. So Tom's actually going to be helping. We're having a client event next week on a Wednesday night. We're calling it a town hall meeting, but it's going to be talking about, you know, asset protection, planning for healthcare costs in retirement. We're going to have Kathleen Weber there, who Kathleen's been on the show before. She's a counselor, family counselor that helps people that are dealing with folks with Alzheimer's and dementia. And then also we'll have a gentleman down from Northern Indiana that's a long-term care specialist. He's not an insurance salesman, but he represents an insurance company. But he's a really, really good advocate for folks that are looking to protect themselves into retirement. Because when I run some spreadsheets on retirement income plans, they'll look great until you inflate out the cost of care. If it costs $80,000 a day, folks, it's going to cost $160,000 in 10 years probably. And then you just keep rolling it up from there. And you throw that into an income plan at 86 or 87, and pow, it's gone. So you got to be aware of this. You got to be careful. So, Tom, once again, thank you so much for being part of the big show. We'll talk to you all again next week as Mick Higley will be our guest. This has been Your Money with David Hayes. Discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Guest opinions on this show do not necessarily represent those of the radio station, David Hayes, or CFCI. You should always consult with an investment professional before making important investment decisions. Investment advice offered through CFCI, an SEC registered investment advisor, 674 South College Avenue, Bloomington, Indiana.